It happens to be a year of firsts. I was in South Africa. Jim talked about that in August. And they had something they did there that I'd never experienced either. I spoke at the Vineyard Church in Pretoria, which is the second largest Vineyard Church in South Africa. And they warned me in advance, but I really thought that they were joking. I honestly did, until I got there. And what they do is for each Sunday morning service, they issue the staff who sit on the speaker's right in the front row with three pieces of cardboard. One of those is green in color, another one is yellow in color, and a third one is red in color. And so in an effort to give immediate feedback to the speaker, they hold up the appropriate card. And so if you're doing well, you get green. And if you're faltering a bit, they give you yellow. And if you have failed to the point that you may not be able to dig yourself out, and it's that moment of just saying, I'm done, you get red. And so that was the first time I've ever had that happen to me. And I thought it was quite interesting. And so I thought I need to do something about this. And so I grabbed a set of those cards myself. And as we began, I explained that I had learned in my 35 years of experience that it really is the congregation that matters most in the success and power of the preacher. And so if everyone's awake and attentive and engaged and laughing appropriately and cheering on cue, then they would get a green card from me. And if there are a few people nodding off and looking inattentive and not showing, not leaning forward at the pinnacle of the stories, then they would get a yellow card. And if I saw worse than that, it would get red. And so they decided to lay aside the cards for my morning. So I appreciated that. So those are two firsts. Hey, has this been a good week? Wow. I've had a bunch of people come up to me and say, this is the best year yet ever, best year yet. And I hear that each time. And so there's a certain pressure, like, what are we going to do for next year? And, you know, for me, this has really been a year, this is a week of nostalgia. I hope I can do this without crying, but it was so great to have Jimmy Reyes here. We have been friends for 20 years. And I used to teach at a Bible college in downtown Los Angeles, and I met Jimmy when he was 19 years old, 20 years ago, 1994. And he had that same heart and passion and would often lead worship as we began the class. And so it just brings back incredible memories to be here and have him as part of leading. The other one, this is not the first time I have carried a baby at a Vineyard Conference. And it occurred to me as I was carrying my granddaughter around that it was 32 years ago that I went to my first Vineyard Conference. I met Wimber in 1978. We were part of Calvary Chapel. We all enjoyed getting the letter of disfellowship and gathered in Orange County, 1982. And my daughter, Christine, who's here, who's the mother of my granddaughter, Emma, was the one we carried. And I guess it just startles me how far we've come. You know, at that time, everyone was kind of licking their wounds and tail between their legs and wondering we would survive. And, you know, here we'd been booted out. And where we are today is just a really different place. And I don't think anyone ever imagined that. And so it is purely the grace and the goodness of God that this thing is what it is. And I am so happy to be a part of it. And so it's just been every time I hold my granddaughter, not only do you see pride and love for that little girl, but it's kind of the amazement of 32 years later what this all has become. And it just is not anything that I ever imagined. Well, we've had a very full week, and so I don't want to wax eloquent for long, but I do want to do two things tonight. The first one is I want to share with you a little bit about what God's doing in my life, and I do that for several reasons, one of which is accountability. Sometimes I see leaders and they start down a path and they talk about something and there's a lot of exuberance around it, and then I don't hear anything about it again, and so I don't really know what's happened. And I want you to know that the spiritual formation things that we've been on a journey on together for the last several years remain ones that I'm deeply committed to. And so I want to talk to you a little bit about what God's doing in my life and some of the things that I feel like God has said to me. And then I want to leave you with three things, nothing, you know, horribly profound or deep, that maybe helps consolidate some of the wonderful things that we've heard and that I just think are some principles that really stand out to me. And so this has been an interesting year for me. It feels in many ways like a year of transition, actually the culmination of a period of time where I've had a sense of impending transition, and that's been really kind of scary for me. I didn't know what that was about. And there's just been some ill ease and some uncertainty and just like, God, what are you doing? And that's, as I said, gone on for some time. And I just have had a major lingering question that I just haven't been able to get an answer to, or hadn't to until earlier this year. And unsurprisingly, I went into a period of what I would call a period of askesis. Now, askesis, as Evan Howard would be far more qualified to break down than I am, is a Greek word that often is translated exercise or discipline. It's actually where we get the idea of spiritual disciplines. And so it started back in December, and I had gone away to this monastery that I go, and I try to get away there for a few days several times a year. And as I reflected on my time there, I realized that the two things that were most valuable about that time were, one was my conversation with one of the monks. I'm developing a friendship with him, and he did a year of study at Fuller when he was on sabbatical, so he understands my world. He still has the little yellow Fuller commuter student sticker on his truck. And I just enjoy talking to him, and it's just fun because I usually get my expertise in spiritual formation things from people like Evan or Steve Summerell, who are also evangelicals, and so it's kind of fun hearing it from like a real Roman Catholic. And so every so often he says something, and I think, that's why I'm not Catholic. So for those of you that are worried that I'm on the road to Rome, I don't think that's what's happening. But I enjoy him very much. The other thing is when I go there, I walk, like for a long time. And I know there's a few people here that have been there, and you go up past the cemetery, and you go out on this plateau, and it looks over the Antelope Valley, and you can see forever. And the only sound up there is the wind. And no matter what happens, that's always the place that God speaks to me. And sometimes I sit and sometimes I walk. And I thought, you know, I don't have to wait till I go away to the monastery to have those times of walking in nature. Because I thought, you know, that's what makes the difference. If I just sit, it's not the same experience as if I walk. And it's being in nature. And I actually don't like the desert very much, but I've really learned to love that place because it's a place that God's met me a number of times. And so I met with my spiritual director, and I've learned to promise and over-deliver. That's like really important to me. And so I said, you know what, Larry, I'm going to commit to one day a month going and walking in nature for an hour and just praying, trying to give the same opportunity I have when I'm in the desert. But what I really was thinking is that I would do it once a week, but I wanted to tell him once a month so that I could over-deliver and, you know, he'd be impressed by my discipline and spirituality. And so I started to do that. I found a place in the area, and within a couple of months, I was basically my time in the morning from 5 a.m. to 9 a.m. was God's time. And I walked and prayed for an hour and a half. I did contemplative prayer. I did Lectio Divina. I did devotional reading. And God just worked some things in me that I don't know would have happened any other way. Let me give you one example. I won't say who they are so I don't get in trouble, but Bubba noted some people that had been angry at him in his talk, and sometimes those people aren't happy with me. And earlier this year, they were unhappy, and I was feeling that rather profoundly, and I got out to start my walk. I'd had, you know, a couple hours with the Lord prior to that, and that was the end, and I realized, you know, I've really been cursed by them and things said. And I was just really frustrated. And God, what are you doing? And why are you doing this? And, you know, you need to silence them and this needs to stop and, you know, on and on. And so I was just complaining to God as I walk. And I'm not sure I'd gotten more than 50 feet before the verse in Luke 6 stood out to me about bless those who curse you. And you know, I think I've taught on that verse. I'm not sure that I have ever actually done that verse. Now, I've thought nice things or wanted to, but I don't know that I have ever actually blessed those that cursed me. And so it took me several weeks. It started out with bless them with the truth, bless them with silence, bless them with a real knowledge of you, bless them with guilt and conviction. And so that was most of that day and the next day and the next day. And slowly I got to the point that, God, I want to bless them. And at the end of 2 weeks, I think that with each of them, I actually got to the point that I wanted to bless them. And as God so often does, the transformation that he causes as we want to do something, see something happen in other people, God does the transformation inside of us. And it's not over yet, but I've watched things that have really been a pain for me and a weight for nearly 15 years, the whole time I've done this role, are starting to change. And I'm a little bit blown away. And I don't know how all those connect, and I'm doing a bad job of communicating. If you imagine that in any way I'm taking responsibility for that, I just know that somehow God prompts in us the prayer that he answers. And so somehow there's this interaction between those. And so I'm actually quite optimistic. Now, I've been traveling a lot since that time, that period of askesis sort of ended in May. And I've been on my rhythms for when I travel. So I haven't had that same time. But God did some really, really good things in me. And I think they're preparatory for some other things I'm going to share. Some people have asked me about my bracelet. And sometimes if I really want to wax eloquent, I talk about how there's three stands, and that stands for the Trinity, and then the belt that the Franciscans wear is called a cincture, and it has three knots, and so I have three knots on here for the vows of poverty and chastity and obedience, and you know what? That's really not true. And I talk about the nautical look and the wind of the Spirit. And, you know, it's like kind of impressive that this is a piece of twine or a rope. It's not quite a lanyard, but close. But the truth is out of that time of spending, I was spent 4 hours a day with God for a lot of months. You know, I realized that I can go through most of the day singularly unaware of God. It's kind of shocked me. Like, even though I spend that time in the morning, by noon, I'm doing my work, and I have, like, forgotten him. And so I put this on because I want God to remind me that he is, like, constantly present with me. And I have a passion and a desire to deepen my relationship with the God so that I'm constantly aware of his presence. Karen and I had the opportunity to attend Dallas Willard's last conference. There's a book that's just come out with the content of it. And it was in Santa Barbara. It was, February of last year. And Willard was dying of cancer, and it was pretty obvious. And barring a miracle, he was going to be passing away within a few months, and everybody knew that. And so there was a real protecting of him, and he didn't speak a lot, and he sat when he spoke, and John Ortberg did more of the teaching. But he said something that just really gripped me, and it seemed to be so powerful, particularly coming from someone who knew that the end of life in this world was visible. I mean, that horizon was right there. And I'm sure he said it far more eloquently, and I want to look online and find the quote again, and I just haven't had time to do it. And it wasn't a part of his teaching, but he just made the statement that when you really walk with God, the transition from this world to the next is really not all that big. And that's the way I want to live my life. And so if you want to pray for me, pray that I remember this bracelet a whole lot more than I do. Because I can still go through major portions of the day and then suddenly realize I have not been cognizant of God being a part of this for far too long. Some things really came to a, a, a peak for me. I went away for another 8-day silent retreat. And so people say, did you cheat? No, I did not, by the way. And I'm an introvert, so those things are a whole lot easier for me. No cell phone, no email, no nothing for 8 days. And the way that Ignatian retreats work is they're based on weeks. Now, they're not necessarily really weeks because you don't move on until you've received the grace that you sought. But the way they're basically structured is week one is about your own sinfulness. Week two is about the life and ministry of Jesus. Week three is about the passion of Jesus. And week four is about the resurrection of Jesus. And so the 8-day retreat, unsurprisingly, is intended to be 2 days on each week. And so I didn't move very quickly through the first week. It took me 5 days to do that. And as we move towards learning to plant thousands of churches, I just really wanted to, for my peace in that, to just give God every opportunity to speak to me as much as I could handle at that moment in my life about my own sinfulness and to challenge me and to say, these are areas that are going to get in the way. Those folks that Bubba mentioned that I won't mention, that hopefully you don't remember exactly what he was talking about. I spent a lot of time on those folks and said, God, you know, what in my life is there that you need to deal with? It took me 5 days to go through that. Just over and over again, God, please press deeper. I know this isn't the end, but as much as I can at this moment, in this place, as mature or immature as I am, you know, just please, I want whatever would be inhibiting for what you want to do, can you deal with it, or at least start me on dealing with it? And I came out of that after this on the 6th day, and it was time to start the life and ministry of Jesus, and I was spending most of my time that day on Luke chapter 10. Part of the key to that is to just really slow down. I think I might have told you the story of going on my first 8-day retreat, and I was given an assignment to spend half a day with a passage in Ephesians chapter 1, and I sat down by in this oak grove, and it was really pretty, and I'm there, and I'm quiet, and I'm reading this, and I'm thinking, this is really cool, and I'm having all these insights, and I thought, this is great. This is going to be super easy. That must have been at least 2 hours, and I look at my watch, and it had been 20 minutes, and I thought, the key to this is to slow way down, and I was going to have to get a lot slower than I'd been going. So I learned that the last time, so I knew what I was getting into. And the question that has really been dogging me is where I put my priorities. And because I've pressed into things of prayer in new ways for me, and I've learned so many things, and my relationship with God is at just such a different place than it has been. I've realized that prayer is a whole lot more about will than it is about words. It's about my commitment to be present to God. It's about listening way more than speaking. I mean, there's just been all these things that I'm finding have made such a difference in my life. And I thought, you know, my gosh, did I do my terminal degree in the wrong discipline? You know, should I, you know, am I really to pursue, you know, a life of prayer to the exclusion of these other things? And I had read Thomas Green's book, When the Well Runs Dry, which is an excellent book, by the way, if you feel like your well is running dry. And he said that everyone that presses into some of the depths of prayer ultimately faces the question, is that God's intention for them to have that as a vocation? That really was my question. You know, and God, what do I do with this? I have this call to the world and God's blessing, and I have vision for that, but I feel called to this and to time and to presence with God, and I'm not sure what to do. And so I spent most of that morning on the passage in Luke chapter 10 where the story of Mary and Martha. And I'm reading that, and I'm, God, what? How does this work? And, you know, and look at what, you know, and Jesus affirms Mary and Martha, you know, and what do I do? And I'd gone to lunch, and you don't talk during lunch, so lunches are really quick. You know, I sit down there in our room, and, you know, everyone hangs around because you're talking. But imagine you go in, and you can't look at anybody, and you can't talk. I mean, you eat, like, really fast. So I came back to my room, and I'm sitting there, and I'm, I've been frustrated. Like, I got to have an answer to this. And I'm sitting on my bed. I remember it so clear. I'm reading that passage. Actually, I was picking up my Bible, getting ready to read the passage another time through. And I felt like God spoke so clearly to me with these words. You're trying to be Mary, but I've made you a Martha. Now, I have no idea how that fits exegetically, and I don't want to go there at this point because I'm afraid I'm going to wreck it. But I know that's what God spoke. And in a way that I cannot explain to you, it answered everything for me. And so I didn't cheat by doing email, but I immediately, I knew what I needed to do, and I knew that the next step in learning to plant thousands of churches was I need to learn from some other people about church planting movements or disciple-making movements. There's some terminology changes there. And so I actually downloaded a book on my Kindle, and I said, God, if this is really you, let there be the same passion about this church planting movements as there has been about prayer. And so I don't know how to say it. I knew what I'm supposed to do. It was the most amazing thing. And in no way should that be understood to say that I'm bypassing or setting aside the things that I have been doing. I'm just as committed as I am. I'm going to go another 8-day retreat, silent retreat in 2 years. I'm getting up to the monastery. I'm on my travel schedule, so I don't have those same amounts of time at home. But I'm deeply committed to those things. And so anything I say from here on out is assumed to be built on that foundation, not replacing it. This is building up from that. And it felt to me like God is saying that I finally have dug deep enough not to keep digging, but that the likelihood of me moving off of that foundation is not high anymore. And so now there was a freedom to move forward. And so I knew that what I needed to do is for the next year and a half, I'm going to devote time to studying church planting movements. And so I have a stack of books that is 3.5 feet tall that I'm working through. And so I am reading Wesley's journals, not an excerpt of Wesley's journals. There are 6 of Wesley's journals, and they're all about that thick. And so I'm only a partway through the first one. But the interesting thing is I know why John Wimber read John Wesley's journals. I'm reading those, and I'm like, now I get it. Because I think Bob Logan mentioned that. I mean, many of us know that he loved to read those journals. And I got into those, and I got to about page 200, and I thought, I know why our founder read these books. And so I am working through that pile of books. It was interesting. I love Steve Nicholson's talk on Count Z, as Joel and his crowd put it. And one of the books, there's a number of these books I've read before, but I've got a whole history, which I have read previously, on the history of the Moravians and the Nestorians and the Jesuits. And I mean, I've got all this stuff that I'm going to read through, and I'm saying, God, what do we need to learn in order to fulfill our mission in this day? What are you calling us to? How do we move from having learned to plant hundreds of churches to planting thousands of churches? The other thing that I'm going to do in the next year is visit other church planting movements. I want to learn from people that have done this. I want to go and I want to say, what have you learned? I have a series of questions. I have some hypotheses that I'm testing. And I'm realizing it's interesting as I'm starting to study this. They're talking about church planting movements really have critical momentum in the 4th and 5th generations of church plants. So this church plants, this church plants, this church plants, this church plants, this church. And you know what? Most of the vineyard is at the 3rd generation. And if what these folks are identifying is true, it's these next 2 generations of church plants that are really critical that make us a movement that's going to be sustained. The interesting thing is I've been asking around. I haven't really done a study, but I've been asking anecdotally. And it appears that there are some places where there are 4th generation vineyard churches. And you know where those are? They're Omero's church plants. So we were talking about this in Africa. It might have been Jim Poole that came up with that, and he suddenly realized, hey, there are some 4th generation church plants in the vineyard. Woo. So the question is, how do we have a whole heck of a lot more of those? We are really at a critical moment, and it's those ones that are really key to carrying us on for the generations past us. And so the first trip is going to be in February. Bob Logan and I are going to go see the church planting movement that you saw the pictures of. Some of you will know the name George Patterson. It's really exciting to me because that was the movement that George Patterson founded. And it turned it over a long time ago to a Honduran brother, and it's all developed from there. But it just is really interesting. So that's the journey I'm on. I want you to know that if you've seen sort of wondered about, do I have clarity? I do now, and I'm excited about it. And so I just can't tell you how important that was for me to feel like at this point that question is settled and I know where I'm supposed to go. So let me give you three quick things that I think we need to think about as we move into this next phase together. Number one, we really do need each other. This is not going to be an individual effort. And on Monday morning when Michael taught, Brenda came up and she gave a word. And do you remember what the word was about there's times when family is really important? I got a new granddaughter. I just visited my other daughter in Indianapolis. And one of the things that she worries about is when they're going to have kids, where are they going to be, there or at home in California? Because at those times of giving birth, family matters. And might it be that as we anticipate the birth of hundreds, thousands of new churches, that family really needs to be present in that time? And that you can give birth without family, but the absence of family makes it way, way, way harder. We need each other. One of the joys of this year was I spent a week up at George Fox University, the Quaker School near Portland, Oregon, in a class that they did on group discernment. And it was interesting on a bunch of levels, but one of them, which is not related to what I'm about to say, but it was kind of funny, is a whole bunch of the people who taught in that program knew John Wimber when he was a Quaker. And so one by one, I had all these people take me aside and say, let me tell you about John Wimber before he was Vineyard. Now, as I said, I met Wimber in 78, so that goes back to the Calvary Chapel days, but not to the days of the Friends Church. And so I talked to people who knew Gunner Payne, and I mean, these names that I had heard from John or were in the books, like they know him, like the one guy taught Gunner Payne's daughter. And so I'm hearing these stories, and the underlying thing that a bunch of them whispered to me is, what would have happened if we hadn't kicked John Wimber out? I don't know. We'd be all, you know, eating Quaker oats and wearing those hats. I don't know. I'm not sure if I'd be a Quaker, but it was an interesting question. But what they said was, they said for 350 years, we've worked at learning to hear God together, and we wonder if group discernment might be our gift to the body of Christ. And I listened to that, and my summary is, it's all theologically predicated on the idea that the risen, ascended, living Christ wants to guide his church in real time. Wow. Huh? And what if Jesus really wants to guide us? And what if we can't gain that guidance alone, but we need other people? And so we're beginning to experiment with discernment as a model of decision making. They have another thing that I find so interesting. The language just throws you, but because they talk about the leader of the meeting is the clerk. And so they have clearness committees. And how many of us have reached a point, I mean, really in some ways, maybe that's where I was at with my question of God, you know, how do I balance the being and the doing in my life? And maybe I needed to wrestle with that long. I don't know. But we face a decision that we just don't know how to make on our own. What if there were a method that we could meet with some other people, not that they make the decision for us, but that they prayerfully sit with us, asking questions to help us perceive what is difficult to perceive on our own. And so that's one of the things that I'm exploring, and I'm excited by the idea that we are able to do this with other people. That's part of the value of a spiritual director. I haven't seen my spiritual director, Larry, since I got back from the retreat. He takes the summer off. And I know what he's going to do when I tell him about you're trying to be Mary and I made you a Martha. I know what he's going to do. He's going to laugh because he's known that all along. And he's watched me struggle, try to move in another direction. He's actually been mean to me on occasion. But horrible thing, isn't it? But others know sometimes what is difficult for us to see. That's actually my point. And when we invite others into that, there's a clarity that just isn't possible on our own. And so what if we began to explore that? And spiritual direction is one of the places that other voice can be there, helping us unpack. The Clearness Committee, what an odd name, or another example of that. We need each other. We are never going to get there. I know that a lot of people around the Vineyard have been impacted by Phil's emphasis over the last several years on challenging cynicism. You know what his next thing is? You guys are going to be the first to know outside the board. Friendship, real friendship. We talk about being a relational movement. What if we really pressed into that? And again, I keep thinking about Brenda's word. What if it's times of birth? Aren't those one of those occasions in the life of a family where you really need the family to be there? And if we really have friendship and we're really in this together, then that whole process is a whole lot easier than it is without that. Number two, we really need to take the long view. If I had one wish for many of the people that I work with, it's that we would think incrementally. I remember Wimber used to say, I know it's not original to him, but he would say, it was in the phase where we were all doing the five-year plans. And I had a big old honking five-year plan, and it was useful till about month one. But gosh, it looked good on the bookshelf. And one of the things he said in those days is we overestimate what we can do in 1 year and we underestimate what we can do in 5 years. And so I think some of us want it all to go really fast. It's interesting, people that study church planting movements have identified the reality that some of which are counterintuitive. And one of those is that church planting movements often spend a long time preparing to grow rapidly. And I think that's the phase that we're in. We're in the preparatory phase. And so we need to take the longer view and build step upon step and realize that if you've made a 10-year commitment to a country, you've got time and you can build in pieces and it doesn't have to happen all at once. And sometimes I watch people want to get it all done fast, and boy, don't we all want that. But we need to take a longer view and we need to build. We need to have something solid, something that God's built that we join in. And so we need to take the long view. And the final thing that I want to say tonight is that we really do need all kinds of churches. You know, we've gotten perhaps a little bit narrow in how we understand a church ought to look. And yet churches can look really differently. And I was really struck. We had a wonderful regional meeting. I'm a part or graciously invited to be a part of the Southern California region that Michelle and Jamie lead. And they've done such a great job. And what you saw last night is certainly illustrative of the quality of people that they are. And we had a great regional conference. And I was deeply impacted by two of the speakers. And one of those was James Chung, and he has a couple of books out there. And if I were you, I would not let those go home with Cheryl. I think they're actually really, really good. And one of those, which was the basis of his talk, was a book called Real Life. And he talks about the nature of discipleship, and he overlays it against the different generations. And then he did this thing that was really concerning to me, and it immediately prompted me to prayer. And he said, okay, how many of you are from the boomer generation? and probably 40% of the room raised their hands. And he said, how many of you are, what is the next one, millennials? Gen X. Gen X. Okay, how many of you are Gen X? And it felt really good because like maybe there were like, you know, 30% of the room raised their hands. And then he said, how many of you are, what is it, Mosaics, millennials? Okay. And like, it was like really bad. And it was like really startling. And so I thought, God, what do we do? Like you know, and who's supposed to reach that next generation? And how do we do this? And so I spent a lot of, I read his book on the plane ride. I heard his talk Saturday morning, and I got on the plane to go to South Africa Saturday afternoon, and I downloaded his book on Kindle. Thank God for Kindle. And I read it on the plane, and I just kept thinking, you know, God, what do we do? What does this generation need? And I got to South Africa, and we were riding around after the conference because we had a meeting of mission leaders after that. And a couple of the guys started telling me about a movement of churches that had come out of the UK that was being established in South Africa called Fresh Expressions. And where it started was in the Anglican Church, in the UK, who realized that they had these buildings that didn't have people. And they began to realize that these buildings were a real gift. Now, we would know that in this room, since there's a whole lot of people who wish they had a building that may or may not have it. So we know that's important. And so they began to say, could these be buildings be leveraged for the sake of the kingdom? And so they began to send people in, and the process was so interesting because it was a long time of prayer and discernment. God, what are you doing here? In whom are you working? What do you want to do? How are you working? And as they identified that, then the next step almost always was love and service to that community. And then as they led with love and service, they earned the right to share the gospel, and they were very intentional about decision making. So it wasn't this sense of, oh, we can't share the gospel. Then they did that. They saw disciples developed, and then they gathered. And so one of those, it actually was a Methodist church on, I don't know, I didn't realize they had surfing in England, but evidently they do. And world-class surfing, right? Like, it's a surfing destination, is it not, John? Yes. Okay, so wherever it is on the UK coast that they have surfing, they had a Methodist church that was sitting empty. And so they sent someone down there to reestablish a congregation, and they spent months praying about what God was doing. And the picture's online. I'm going to tell you the name of this because I love the name. If nothing else, that's inspired. But they sat there for a long time, and they realized that there were all these surfers, and they could identify no connection between those surfers and any Christian witness whatsoever. And so they had this building, and they took the basement, and they put in a coffee bar, and they put in showers, and they put in lockers, and they said, we're going to serve the surfers. And there is now in that building a surfer church. And they've repeated this literally hundreds of times. And it's progressed so that it's no longer the building that it's about. It's just fresh expressions of the church. And by the way, the name of that church is the Tube Station. Yeah, pretty cool, huh? I like that. So anyway, if you don't get it, John will explain that to you. And so they have scores of these. And I've shared that story with some people who were millennials. And you know what I heard? I heard these words. I never thought of myself as a church planter, but I think I could plant a church like that. Interestingly enough, the Fresh Expressions U.S. website is not that great, but the U.K. one's really, really good. I hate to admit that, but that's the truth. So if you're going to look it up, that's the one to look at. And they have scores of videos. And I spent a Saturday morning, not work time, just looking at those videos. And it looked to me like at least a third of the pastors were women. And I thought, isn't that interesting? And maybe it takes a new model of the church to really give place to people who want to be creative and who maybe don't see themselves ministering in the traditional way. But God doesn't always minister in the traditional way. And there's story after story, and they realize they're fragile. They're all in the first generation. They're all new believers. But it's a new kind of church. And I think that as we think about the world around us, we've got to think that church is not always going to look the same. And so that's what I want to remind us tonight. Number one is we really do need each other. Discernment is one example of that, but it's not the only one. None of us can do this alone. And that's been one of the cool things. I sat next to Todd Rosenwald at dinner tonight, and he goes, hey, and Todd works in China, and he's working with lepers. And he goes, did you know there's someone from the Vineyard working with lepers in Africa? No, I didn't. Well, Tri told me that there was, and I'm going to connect with them. And I've listened to scores of people share with me that one of the things they came away from this time with is they're not alone. That's right. We got to take the long view. We can accomplish way more than we think in 5 years and probably way less than we think in 1 year. But we've got to take that approach of building. It's not all going to get done in a year. And it's not unusual for the church planting movements that God's birthed to take a long time to ramp up to be able to handle the multiplication that comes. And again, finally, we need all kinds of churches. And I offer that as one expression, pun intended, of the church. And so that's what I want to do. I want to end my time tonight. Michael and Marvin are going to come back up and lead us in a ministry time. But last year, I closed with a prayer from someone named Charles de Foucault. And tonight, I want to end by praying for us a prayer from John Wesley, again, lest you think I'm becoming Catholic. And if I'd planned ahead, I don't really do PowerPoint, and there's reasons for that, but I'm out of time, so I won't explain that to you. But I'd have had it up there so we could all read it. But I'm going to read it for us. So would you stand with me and just listen to these words that were so vital to the Wesleyan movement. Again, that movement that so inspired our founder that he read over and over again that journal. And then Marvin and Michael will come up and they'll take over from there. So listen to these words as I read them. I'll put them in the plural for us. We are no longer our own, but yours. Put us to what you will. Rank us with whom you will. Put us to doing. Put us to suffering. Let us be employed for you or laid aside for you. Exalted for you or brought low for you. Let us be full. Let us be empty. Let us have all things. Let us have nothing. We freely and heartily yield all things to your pleasure and disposal. And now, O gracious and blessed God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, you are ours and we are yours. So be it. And let the covenant which we have made on earth be ratified in heaven. Amen.